This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Like the kōkako, the saddleback, or tieke, belongs to the New Zealand wattlebird family. A family to which the huia belonged and which has been established in this country since ancient times, much longer than most of our other birds. The saddleback takes its name from the bright reddish saddle on its back, which according to legend is the mark of Maui's hand. Sadly, this attractive bird has disappeared from the main islands and exists only on a few offshore islands, carefully chosen locations for resettlement away from predators, which appears to have saved the tieke from total extinction.
Community or chaos, we can construct and nurture community or fall into chaos. Over the next hour, Marvin Hubbard hosts conversations toward creating a fairer, more equal society.
Community or Chaos is made possible with the support of Quakers Aotearoa. You'll find them online at quaker.nz.
Good morning, friends. Today we have Robert Patman, Professor of Political Studies and International Relations at Otago University, and we'll be talking about unilateralism and world cooperation, basically. You can podcast this by going to oar.org.nz and then going to podcast and going to Community or Chaos. Robert, briefly, what until recently has been the foundation of New Zealand's foreign policy? And can you tell us what a multilateral foreign policy might be and means?
You not hear me?
Yeah, now I do.
Oh, good. Since 1945, New Zealand has pursued a foreign policy, what might be described as support for an international rules-based order that's enshrined in institutions like the United Nations and norms such as multilateralism. It shouldn't be forgotten that New Zealand, under Peter Fraser, who was Prime Minister of New Zealand between 1940-1949, played an important role in the emergence of the United Nations. And basically, all governments since then, to greater or lesser extent, have supported the UN and seen multilateralism as a key aspect of New Zealand's foreign policy. What is multilateralism? It's basically the diplomatic arrangement whereby three or more countries cooperate on a perceived common goal. And what's good for small countries and middle powers about multilateralism is that it gives them a voice that they might otherwise not have in international affairs. And so, in short, for small and middle powers, multilateralism is an important diplomatic tool. What we've seen in the last decade or so, certainly since 9/11, we've seen the erosion of the vision of a rules-based international order. And also we've seen a decline of multilateralism. You've had countries like the United States in 2003 illegally invade Iraq without the sanction or support of the UN Security Council. And then we had Russia illegally annexing Crimea in 2014. And then invading Ukraine in 2022. And now, of course, we have the illegal attacks by the United States and Israel, which were launched on the 28th of February this year against Iran. There's a shaky ceasefire now in place. Why do I mention all this? It's because for countries like New Zealand and middle powers like Australia, what is happening internationally is a matter of great concern, because we rely on an international rules-based international order to have a voice in international politics and to conduct our business, our trade with the rest of the world. So what we're seeing is a fraying of multilateralism.
It appears to me that Trump doesn't have any respect for small nations or even middle-sized ones, and therefore doesn't have any respect for multilateralism.
That's true. Mr. Trump's been quite explicit on that. If you look at the administration's track record, but also what it says is his foreign policy vision. The United States National Security Statement released in late November 2025 doesn't pull any punches about this. It basically only supports multilateralism. It doesn't support multilateralism unless it's explicitly in line with the interests of what it says is America first. It also indicates that it doesn't have much time for the United Nations either. So what is the vision of the Trump administration? It basically sees the world being run by great powers. And it's quite explicit on this document. Basically, the Trump administration believes that things like sovereignty and patriotism and nationalism are the key factors determining world politics. So in the 21st century, the Trump administration envisages the world being run by a concert of great powers consisting of the United States as head of the table, and then China, Russia, India, and Japan. All this is written down. Now, that view, that top-down hierarchical view of global politics is completely opposite to what successive New Zealand governments have projected as foreign policy. So there is a real clash here between the views of some of the great powers. By the way, Trump's views on international politics sit quite comfortably with those of Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping. So you could argue what we're witnessing in the 21st century, and I think Mark Carney gave some articulation to this perspective, we're witnessing a new fault line in global politics between the great powers who do not want to be constrained too much by international law or multilateral arrangements and prefer the scope to act unilaterally. So that on the one hand, you've got great powers who are selective about international law, and the great majority of countries, perhaps many as 188, middle powers and small countries, which rely strongly on the maintenance of international law. So Mark Carney in his speech at Davos in February alluded to this split that's developing. He argued that middle powers were not, and for that matter, small powers were not powerless in this situation. But we are witnessing a substantial fraying of the multilateral order.
Have both Canada to some extent and New Zealand failed to strengthen multilateralism when they didn't protest as strongly as they could have against genocide in Gaza and against the attack on Iran?
I think that's absolutely the case. Liberal democracies, including New Zealand, have adopted a softly approach in the hope that a so-called policy of constructive engagement would moderate the Trump administration and make them less revisionist and less radical. But the point is that the Trump administration is a complete departure from anything we've seen in US foreign policy since 1947. And what is interesting is that a number of liberal democracies, including our government, have persisted with the fiction that it's business as normal in Washington and that Trump can be won round through flattery and cooperation. And that meant that New Zealand has been tongue-tied on a number of crucial issues. For example, when Mr. Trump openly threatened and repeatedly has threatened Canada with invasion, New Zealand did not speak out in defence of a fellow Five Eyes member. And that's very disappointing. It was done on the basis, the softly approach was adopted on the basis that Mr. Trump was erratic and that if you treat him nicely, he will respond in kind. Actually, Trump shows no indication that he's responding positively to this softly, softly approach. If anything, it's emboldened Trump. And Mr. Trump has been quite candid. He says he doesn't take international law. He doesn't regard international law as a constraint on his foreign policy behaviour. He said that the only thing that constrains him is his sense of consciousness, which I'm not sure should be particularly reassuring. But that's what he says. So I think you're right. I think that New Zealand has, for the first 17, 18 months of the Trump administration, persisted, like many other liberal democracies, with a few exceptions, with the notion it was possible to do business with an administration which does not share the values and the interests of most New Zealanders. So I think that reasoning is now beginning to unravel, because a number of countries, particularly since Carney's speech in Davos, have realised it doesn't matter how much you flatter Mr. Trump, you cannot appease a bully. If anything, Mr. Trump's demands escalate over time if countries do not say no to him. And at some point, many liberal democracies, I believe, and we are seeing this. We're seeing this in Europe, where, for example, Ursula von der Leyen has said that the West as we've known it is over. And you've seen it in Spain, a member of the EU, of course. We're seeing it in Ireland to some degree. But it's going to take some political courage, Marvin, for the middle powers and the smaller countries to say to the United States and to the likes of China, we believe your behaviour is unacceptable and we won't accept it. Why? Because the United States and China are the biggest trade partners of most countries in the world. So it's very difficult for countries to do, to summon up that courage. But your question raises a really important point. If liberal democracies like New Zealand do not summon up the courage, they will find themselves complicit in dismantling a rules-based international order on which they depend. So at some point, and it's quite soon, I believe, many liberal democracies face the sort of question that Edmund Burke once posed when he said that politics is often a choice between the disagreeable and the intolerable. And I think now we're reaching that point where many countries, to protect their own interests, will have to unsettle the White House in doing so.
Do you think that one reason for both the United States and Russia to deny the need for action on climate change and planetary environment is because dealing with these kind of crises, you need multilateral cooperation in the UN and institutions such as the UN?
Yes. What we're witnessing here is not great powers running the world, but a lack of global leadership. Let's be quite clear here, Marvin. If you look at the post-Cold War era, great powers can act unilaterally, but do they do it successfully? The record says no. The United States invasion of Iraq was not a swimming success. It was actually one of the worst strategic disasters in American history. The Russian invasion of Ukraine has been a catastrophic experience. After nearly 5 years, the Russians still only control about 19% of Ukraine. And they're beginning to experience real difficulties at home as a result of that invasion effort. And now we've seen the recent attacks by the US and Israel. Again, no international backing, no consultation with allies. They acted unilaterally. What are the results? Well, we know the international community no longer has access to the Strait of Hormuz, which is causing a global economic crisis. And the Iran's retaliation to the unilateral attacks by the US and Israel was to launch massive and devastating retaliation against Americans' allies in the Gulf states. So when you think about it, there is a difference between being able to do something and achieve. On the one hand, you can do things. On the other hand, does those actions achieve successful results? I don't think the record is particularly encouraging for unilateral action. So, you know, you have countries like Russia, China, and the United States, which jealously defend their great power prerogatives. And they can, you know, through the use of the veto, which inflates their power artificially in the world, they can block anything they don't like in the UN. But the problem for them is that they can't impose their own solutions. So in a short, we are at a crossroads in international politics. We have, on the one hand, rising geopolitical tensions. But unfortunately, for most of the countries concerned, they have little prospect of running the world. And that means that sooner or later, you raise climate change in your question. That's a really important question, a really important issue to raise, because it's symptomatic of the constraints that great powers face in the 21st century. What are those constraints? A proliferation of problems that do not respect borders. Problems like climate change, global pandemics, transnational terrorism, problems of economic contagion that we're witnessing at the moment, occasioned by the attacks on Iran. These problems don't respect borders. They can't be fixed by great powers. They dwarf great powers. And this is the really challenging thing. Although it's very difficult to build multilateral solutions to these problems, they can't be solved by any other way. And so the challenge in the 21st century is going to be essentially deciding whether we want to fix these problems. And if we do, we will, as an international community, have to engage kicking and screaming in self-interested international cooperation. Otherwise, problems like climate change, which is the most severe threat to the security of human life on Earth, will just remain unaddressed.
It appears to me that both Putin and Donald Trump are elected authoritarians.
I'm not sure Putin, I would describe, I mean, elections since he's been in power, going back to 2000 when he became president, they are not elections in the Western sense.
No, they weren't.
These are simulated elections in which most of the competitive rivals he faces are either incarcerated or worse, killed. And also, there's no equal airtime between Putin and his party and his rivals. So we all know who's going to win an election in Russia. It's always Mr. Putin. He's been there 30 years. I think the American situation is different, but it could be said that Mr. Trump has shown scant regard for the US Constitution. Essentially, the administration appears to be lawless. It doesn't respect international law and is proud of that. And in the eyes of many Americans, it's not all that, it's not very good in acknowledging domestic law either. So, we do have several countries in the world who deny problems like climate change. Why do they deny them? Well, because they can't solve them on their own, which comes back to your question. Yes, they are hostile to problems like that because they know that the only way they can participate in solving them is to work with others. And they pretend that they are, you know, the product of manifest destiny, Russian civilization or American exceptionalism. The idea that, you know, they're not subject to the same constraints as everyone else. Well, good luck with that one, because climate change, unfortunately, has no time for being called a hoax. It will go on irrespective.
Well, one of the factors I see between both Putin and Trump is their inability to accept they make mistakes, their inability to change policy when it's not working.
I'm sure that's the same for Xi Jinping as well, who's also got a reputation for surrounding himself with cronies. All authoritarian leaders or wannabe authoritarian leaders often set themselves up for the perfect storm by excluding talented, independent people in their circle. They want to be authoritarian leaders like to live in echo chambers, but those very same echo chambers mean they are destined to make horrendous mistakes. I mean, look at Mr. Trump's claim that everyone was surprised by Iran's retaliation by seizing the Strait of Hormuz and attacking the Gulf states. Well, the Pentagon has been wargaming that every year for the last 30 years and always said, if attacked, Iran's first reaction will be to seize the Strait of Hormuz. And yet he proclaimed surprise. He may have been genuinely surprised because he may not have been given the sort of advice that he needs to get to make sensible decisions.
Well, it seems to me that the world's going to pay a price, but also the United States is going to pay a price. They may have enough oil and so on, but the price of oil is going up even for them.
Yes, we shouldn't underestimate the domestic pressures that are flowing from the consequences of Trump's actions. And it's not just a problem for the United States. Ironically, the US is less affected by the consequences of the administration's actions than other countries like New Zealand.
Well, and they have access to
oil. We are in a situation where so many countries around the world, in the global south and in the developed world. Sorry?
They have, America, perhaps unfortunately in this case, has access to oil through domestic situation. And also they control Venezuela now. I mean, they're.
Yeah, but they cannot. But, you know, this is a short-term relief for the United States that they have access to more oil than other countries in the developed world. But that was only a short-term relief. America is part of the global economy and is a successful player in it. And if the global economy continues to endure a crisis because of American actions, the consequences of that crisis will blow back into the United States. And they are. The price of gasoline is going up rapidly in the US, and food as well as fuel are showing price increases. So, you know, it's all very well the administration saying they're not affected by what's happening, but that's bluff, and the effects will catch up. And the administration faces the midterm elections in November.
That'll be something we should watch very carefully. The Supreme Court hasn't been great.
I think in two senses.
The Supreme Court is very biased toward the Trump administration politically at this point. Most of them were appointed by Trump, and they've allowed.
Well, that's because Mr. Trump has picked many of the people for the Supreme Court.
But they've allowed Republican states to change electoral boundaries, which favor the Republicans and also disadvantage, especially Afro-Americans, but others too. And this is something to worry about when it comes to the midterm elections. Though things may get so bad that no matter how the boundaries are changed, that they may still lose. If enough people vote, and enough people vote against the Trump administration, while all the district finessing won't keep them in power, or won't keep them in Congress.
No, well, I suppose that is that there's no doubt that the Trump administration will, and is quite clear by its actions, attempts to gerrymander electoral districts, etc., wants to redefine the landscape to favour the Republican Party, which is very unpopular, or the administration, the Trump administration, is very unpopular at the moment in the United States. Record low approval ratings, according to polls. But you're quite right. If there is a seismic rejection of Trump's policies, attempts to manipulate the elections could be overwhelmed by the shift of public opinion. We just don't know. But it seems to me, judging by the twitchy reaction of the Republican Party in recent weeks, the Republican Party is getting very nervous. And it desperately wants, and the Trump administration wants, to exit from the war of Iran.
It's much easier to get into a war than get out of it. So who should our allies be in this?
Yes, that's the one of those historical lessons that... Sorry?
Who should our allies be? I mean, we actually need... I'm not thinking about military lines so much as trading partners and working together to build a rebuild multilateralism.
New Zealand needs to recast its foreign policy to put on an emphasis on building, to realign its foreign policy with middle and small powers. That includes countries like Canada and Australia. Australia's our only formal ally. And I think we need to rebuild relations with the global south as well. I think New Zealand should have a semi-detached attitude towards the Trump administration. It should actually probably mirror the stance that it takes towards China. We're happy to do business with China, but we do not accept Chinese political ideas about running New Zealand society. Conversely, or similarly, I think with regard to the Trump administration, with its top-down view of international politics, I think we should be willing to cooperate where interests converge, but not taking a step back on our fundamental values, our commitment to multilateral diplomacy, our commitment to international solutions to international problems. So I do think there is the scope for New Zealand to rethink its foreign policy. That could mean looking to countries of Scandinavia and the Ukraine for more defence cooperation, also looking to the EU countries, Germany in particular. There is lots of potential and possibilities. One thing I think is clear is that middle powers and small countries like New Zealand have to get over the fantasy that great powers are going to look after them. They're not. And they have to start injecting some agency into their foreign policy and being realistic and clear-eyed about the world we live in.
Does Australia have a problem with having a multilateral foreign policy because they're close relations with the United States, especially their defense relations? In some ways, they're a military base for America.
They are, but there's a lot of Australian opposition to that stance. You only have to look at former prime ministers Malcolm Turnbull and Paul Keating. Both strongly reject AUKUS as a infringement on Australian sovereignty, and also say it makes Australia too dependent on the United States. So we are witnessing a bit of debate in Australia about AUKUS, but you're right. Traditionally, both Canada and Australia have looked to the United States for defence cooperation. We're now seeing Canada essentially revisit that under Carney. It's going to be a very difficult process of making new arrangements, but they're doing so. And I would not be surprised if Australia, particularly if after Trump goes, we have a Trump-like leader emerging. Australia, to answer your question, Marvin, Australia may be pro-American, but it's based on a memory of an administration that no longer exists. Australia was pro-American in the era of Bush, Obama, and the first Trump administration. and then the Biden administration. But this second Trump administration is a radical break from anything we've seen in a post-war period. So Australia and Canada face the uncomfortable realization that historically they have been pro-American in defense terms, but they're now dealing with a different type of administration. What are military alliances and partnerships all about? Why do you have an alliance with another country? Well, you do that. Australia historically had an alliance with the United States, and New Zealand had an alliance with Australia, as well as a very close military partnership with the US. Why? Because though parties in question perceived they shared common interests and values, but that no longer exists. Few Australians and few Kiwis share Mr. Trump's view of the world. And so you could say that the vital ingredients for military partnership are now missing. So it's incumbent on Australia, Canada, New Zealand to take stock of that, the reality of that situation. And I think that's going to happen. So I do think we could be witnessing the beginning of a realignment. It may, I know the current government's very reluctant to accept that the Trump administration is a radical departure from the past, but the penny will drop at some point.
The what was your reaction when the Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth, said the New Zealand was freeloading off American military because of its low level of military spending? We've just increased our military spending, by the way, by 2%, I think.
Yeah, I mean, put this in context. First of all, New Zealand raised its expenditure last year to set itself the goal of spending 2% of GDP on defence. That was long overdue, in my view. If you're a multilateral player, you've got to have something to bring to the table if you're seeking to solve security problems in cooperation with allies. So New Zealand did that for New Zealand reasons. Pete Hegseth, the US Secretary of War, so-called Secretary of War, he said we were a freeloader. Well, let's be quite clear about this. He's in no position to talk. The United States under Mr. Trump has been a freeloader on international law. In fact, they've virtually ignored it. And New Zealand and the United States has not demonstrated it's a good ally of New Zealand. So it's all very well making demands, saying to New Zealand, you can't be a close ally of the United States unless you raise your defense expenditure to 3.5% of GDP. Otherwise, you're a freeloader. I mean, that doesn't make any sense when the United States under Trump is threatening a key member of the Five Eyes, which is Canada, when it's making territorial claims against Greenland, when it's abducting leaders, the leader of Venezuela, when it's launching illegal attacks against Iran. I mean, none of those actions are consistent with being a good ally of New Zealand. So, in short, Mr. Hegseth's claim seems to be based on the assumption that a good ally of the United States does what it's told. It seems to be trying to insert a master-servant relationship. I don't think anyone in this country will find that politically acceptable. I tell you what, any government trying to raise defense expenditure in the face of pressure from the Trump administration, they will face a very difficult political sell, because that would be very difficult to persuade Kiwis. We should be strengthening a US-led alliance when that Trump administration is effectively dismantling a rules-based international order in which New Zealand depends on.
Would you say that it's a good thing that we still have the nuclear-free zone in dealing with the United States in particular? That's a fault line.
It's a point of our identity as an independent actor. We were prepared to incur the anger of the United States in the mid-80s. when we injected some sovereignty into our security policy by adopting a non-nuclear security policy. It certainly caused a political rift with the United States. The interesting thing was, it was the United States that blinked first. It wasn't New Zealand that caved in. It wasn't New Zealand that, in a sense, made the first move. It was the Bush administration. The Bush administration basically accepted New Zealand's terms for ending the rift, which is, why not agree to disagree on the nuclear factor, which was always the New Zealand position. But anyway, coming back to the present situation, it shouldn't be forgotten that New Zealand was one of the leaders that pushed for the treaty concerning the abolition of nuclear weapons in 2021. So I think, judging by the quite rapid reaction of the Luxon government this morning, New Zealand will not be backtracking on its commitment to non-nuclear security. It's got bipartisan support in this country. And the other thing here is, all governments in this country are trying to improve our commercial position, our trade position in the Indo-Pacific, which is the engine of the global economy. Countries in the Pacific Island nations, countries in Southeast Asia would not be pleased if we were seen to backtrack or take a step backwards with respect to efforts of nuclear non-proliferation. Why do I say that? The Treaty of Rarotonga, 1986, created a nuclear weapon-free zone in the Pacific Island Nation region. And then the Treaty of Bangkok in 1995 created a nuclear weapons-free zone for the countries of ASEAN. So these are very important countries to New Zealand. So we'd have to be very careful if we were seen to giving in to American pressure to revisit the nuclear question. That could be interpreted as weakness, and it could be seen as being at odds with our friends in Southeast Asia and also in the Pacific Island nations.
Our cooperation in the Pacific Island nations is really quite important, isn't it?
It is. 65% or thereabouts of our overseas development aid goes to that region. And we have been concerned by China's growing interest and assertiveness in the region. The interesting thing is, and sometimes this point is overlooked, countries of ASEAN, Southeast Asia, and the Pacific Island nations, they don't consider themselves to be pawns in a great power game between US and China. They see themselves as having their own national security concerns and their own, if you like, aspirations. And that's very important to keep in mind because, as I say, the perception might be, particularly amongst the Pacific Island nations, if we took a backward step on our commitment to non-nuclear security, that we were returning to the Anglosphere. I'm not saying that's true, but there could be a perception. So, New Zealand, I think, I know the Defence Minister Penk said over the weekend, we should have a conversation about this issue. I don't think it's going to go very far, though, because I think it will be domestically divisive. And also, it would be seen as giving in to possible pressure from the United States.
There's another issue that's really of concern to the South Pacific nations, the Asia itself, but also particularly the island nations, and that's climate change.
Oh, yeah.
And doesn't...
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, the climate change for most Pacific Island nation leaders is the number one security issue. And it's sometimes... just because Washington says under Mr. Trump climate change is a hoax, well, at least two island states are facing existential threats from rising sea levels associated with climate change. So to them, it's far from a hoax. It's a reality. And they will want to devote their efforts to warding off the prospect that their existence will be threatened in this way. So you're absolutely right. For most Pacific Island nation states, national climate change is the number one national security issue facing them.
Won't they expect us not to backtrack on our policy of mitigation of climate change?
Well, that's true again. New Zealand has tended to, all governments have emphasized our special relationship with the Pacific Island nation states, but there is a tendency to assume it's a bit of a one-way street. And for example, when we considered AUKUS, membership of AUKUS, which wasn't greeted with great enthusiasm in the Pacific Island nation states, as far as I can see, we didn't engage in widespread consultation. We haven't made a decision about it. That's very true. But we have been exploring some sort of associate membership of AUKUS. So I do think if we were more sensitive to Pacific Island nation concerns about climate change, that might act as a bit of a constraint on governments in this country backtracking on their commitments to climate change.
How do you see the future of the United Nations?
Mixed. There's no doubt about it. The United Nations at the moment is underfunded and marginalized. And that's because, of course, it's the reasons for this, let's be quite clear, the United Nations is only strong or as weak as its member states allow it to be. It is an interstate organization. And for reasons we've gone through already in this discussion, the most powerful countries in the world have decided that they will use their veto to support their national interests as opposed to the international interest. So at the moment, the UN is probably at its weakest point in the post-Cold War era. The irony is it's never been more needed because we have a growing list of transboundary issues, issues that don't respect borders, that, you know, these problems can only be solved through multilateral diplomacy. And the UN is the logical forum for achieving international coordination to deal with these truly gigantic problems that dwarf superpowers. So it's kind of ironic, really, that the UN should be coming into its own, but it's not, because many states are effectively holding it back. I think a key issue, Marvin, is whether the middle powers and the small countries can achieve sensible reform of the UN. The UN is basically a ramshackle organization. It's underfunded, deliberately underfunded, and it has huge responsibilities, but it often lacks the capability to live up to those responsibilities. I think the most important reform is for the powers of veto to be constrained. And that's a really worrying issue for me, because at the moment, the perk that five countries have, which is the veto in the UN Security Council, the UN Security Council is the body formally responsible for upholding peace and security globally. At the moment, that means that five countries effectively dictate matters of war and peace for the whole world. Now, that may feel good for them, but the rest of the world is paying the price for that privilege and that perk. And I think it's high time that the rest of the world, the 188 countries, about 188 countries, begin to make their voice heard on this issue. It's certainly not popular. And I think the UN needs to consider rule change. The General Assembly, which houses all members of the UN, 193 of them, at the moment can pass endless resolutions, but none of them are binding. There may be scope for a new innovation whereby any resolution passed by the General Assembly by more than two-thirds of its members should be able to overrule any veto by the UN Security Council. So there is ways forward, but again, it's going to need leadership. I think that leadership could come from middle powers or the UN. It's interesting that President Zelensky said in April 2022 that when the Ukraine war was over, he reserved the right to reform the UN, lead a campaign to reform the UN Security Council. Of course, Ukraine was a victim of the current situation. You could argue that the veto is one of the biggest destabilizing factors of global security in the 21st century. And it does need to be addressed.
I mean, when Russia invaded Ukraine, if they hadn't had been able to veto the Security Council could have played a strong role in opposing
Yeah, I
that.
Mean, in a ridiculous situation where the UN Security Council couldn't condemn the invasion of one country by Russia, just tore up the UN Charter. It violated the territorial integrity of Ukraine, and it violated its state sovereignty. And yet, the UN Security Council couldn't issue a condemnation because Russia could use the veto to block that prospect. So it makes a mockery of the current situation. In short, the use of the veto is inconsistent with a rules-based international order. It means that some countries can always block laws they don't like.
Does our greatest hope in restoring the UN really set with the Assembly, the General Assembly of the UN? Is that where reform has to come?
I think, yeah. I mean, when you talk about the General Assembly, you mean the countries that make up the General Assembly. People say, oh, the permanent five members who have the veto, they'll never give it up. They won't give it up if they're never asked. I don't buy this argument that the UN reform cannot be sensibly reformed. Let's think back, Marvin, and you probably know more about this than I do, but you think back to the 50s when African Americans, many of them, didn't have the vote in the United States. And then we had the civil rights movement. Well, you would be forgiven, wouldn't you, if you were an African American in the 50s for believing, despite the end of the Civil War, which abolished slavery, it still hadn't delivered many of the rights that white Americans had. And you may, if you were an African American in the early 50s or the mid 50s, you may have been forgiven to say, well, it's always going to be that way. But of course, there were people like Dr. Andrew Young, there were people like Martin Luther King, and there were others who took the view that not all was lost. And they fought a courageous, sometimes quite violent, they were subject to quite severe violence. They fought a civil rights campaign, and eventually they succeeded with the passing of legislation in 1965. So I do not accept that the current weak situation we find in the UN can continue indefinitely. So a lot depends on courage of players in the UN Security Council. I do think the middle powers and the small countries have a huge stake in changing the status quo. This international status quo is not working for the majority of countries in the world. It's working very nicely for five permanent members. But should the majority of countries in the world continue to pay the price for the privilege of five countries? I don't think so. And I think there's no reason why we should accept the inadequate performance of the UN as it is at the moment.
You know, we talk about, to some extent, solidarity between people. We also need the small nations and middle nations need solidarity between themselves.
Yes, they do. And we also need leadership. One of the things that's depressed me is the fact that we seem to have a generation of leaders who have no sense of history. I mean, after all, any leaders with who had any intellectual grasp of history would have realized that you do not appease bullies in office. I mean, they're only trying to appease a bully, whether it be Mr. Trump, Xi Jinping, or Putin, will only encourage them. And that was one of the key lessons of the 1930s.
Even appeasement the Pope realizes does not work. That's, even the Pope realizes that's right.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is, at the moment, no. I'm confident there will be new leaders coming forward. But at the moment, we do seem to have a dearth of courageous leadership. I think the Spanish government at the moment has been courageous in recent months. And we've seen some leadership from the Irish government. But this attempt to pursue daddy diplomacy towards Trump, of course, it was never going to work. And and liberal democracies now need to take stock with respect to their relations with the Trump administration.
Do you feel like the world economy is actually in danger because of what's happening in the Strait?
Well, it is in danger. And we're not, you know, people who know a lot more about the global economy than I do are very nervous indeed, because as we've seen the global financial crisis 2008, 2009, once there is a runaway loss of confidence, the consequences can be devastating. And we've seen a number of stock market crashes in the past, 1929, 1987, 2008, 2009. And we are, the economy, in a sense, is more interconnected, Marvin, than ever before. This is not the Cold War era, where you had almost two rival economic systems. This is, even a communist power like China is a very successful market player. So the reverberations from the current situation and the global economy today is characterized by long global supply chains. You know, it really does have the potential to have systemic and perhaps catastrophic consequences. So, yes, I think this current situation is very worrying. I'm particularly concerned if the ceasefire talks break down between the US and Iran, and Iran chooses to retaliate by encouraging the Houthis to exercise some control over the Bab el-Mandab Straits, which link the Red Sea to the Indian Ocean. About 10% of seaborne oil goes through that strait. If you think about it, if commercial traffic is restricted through both the Strait of Hormuz and the Bab el-Mandab Straits, then we could be facing a really serious economic situation globally.
Well, it seems to me that those middle countries and small states, we really have to get our act together. We don't seem to have all the time in the world.
We don't. And I think Mark Carney's speech at Davos raised hopes that Canada might lead the way. There is negotiations going on between the Comprehensive and Progressive Trans-Pacific Partnership, consisting of 12 economies, and the EU, consisting of 27 economies, that there will be a trade deal between those two entities, which would create a market of 1.5 billion people and exclude China and the United States. If that deal comes off, it might set a precedent. It might invigorate confidence amongst the middle powers and the smaller countries that they can do things without the great powers. But they certainly, at the moment, I do see this fault line developing between the great powers on the one hand and the overwhelming majority of countries on the other, middle powers and small countries, which are largely being dictated to by great powers that cannot solve the world's problems on their own. And this is one of the, I think, key challenges going forward in the next few decades.
Well, Robert, thanks a lot for coming along. We've been talking to Robert Patman about the importance of multilateral foreign policy and the interrelations between the problems we have and the need for world cooperation. Thanks a lot, Robert.
Thanks, Marvin.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.